In this retreat, we'll have a combination of sutta studies, usually during the daytime, and some Dharma talks and meditation practice, usually in the evenings. But it might change and vary, so we'll let you know each day as things evolve. I'm glad you have your sutta packets. If you have the wish to read some of it, we'll probably tomorrow work with maybe up to the first 20 pages or so, and you're very welcome to take a look at it in advance. However, it's not necessary. If you want to focus on the meditation rather than the reading, that is also quite fine, and then we'll read some of those passages together. And I will periodically tell you when I really need you to read something in advance. But if you felt like poking at it a bit and before you go to bed this evening or over lunch tomorrow, then you're very welcome to look at the first, say, 20 pages or so. Now, tonight I'd like to speak about joy. And I'd like to begin with a passage from the Samyutta Nikaya that says, if wanderers of other sects ask you, for what purpose, friends, is the holy life lived under the ascetic Gotama? Being asked thus, you should answer those wanderers thus. It is, friends, for the full understanding of suffering that the holy life is lived under the Blessed One. You're probably thinking, I thought I came to a retreat titled Training in Happiness, not the full understanding of suffering. In fact, the full understanding of suffering really doesn't sound like it would be a very effective advertising pitch. And it's no wonder that Buddhism is associated with suffering and sometimes appears a bit grim. The Four Noble Truths do play a very central role in the Dharma teachings, and the first noble truth is that suffering must be fully known. But for those of you that have already read some of the discourses of the Buddha, you'll know that you can't read very far into the texts without also realizing that there are many, many references to happiness, to joy, to contentment, to tranquility, and to peace. In the middle-length discourses, we find that at one point, King Pasenadi of Kosala greets the Buddha, and he's so devoted, he's so happy to see the Buddha, and he's praising him and appreciating the Buddha and the Sangha of monks. Because he says, here I see bhikkhus smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful, plainly delighting, their faculties fresh, living at ease, unruffled, subsisting on what others give, abiding with a mind like a wild deer. I love this image of the monastic Sangha, smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful, plainly delighting, their faculties fresh. Many times we find the Buddha and his disciples and the Sangha at large described as cheerful, happy, radiant. Some famous discourses begin with a disciple asking, how is it that the Buddha and his disciples, though they possess few comforts and are leading a life of renunciation, appear so radiant, so sparkling, that their skin shines and they appear happy and joyful? As we discuss happiness during this week-long retreat, I think it's important to remember that in the Buddhist tradition, happiness is not limited to the scope of pleasant sensual encounters. It's not dependent upon getting, having, or feeling pleasurable sensory experiences. The Buddha included in his definition of happiness feelings that were peaceful and equanimous. and feelings that arise in those refined and non-sensual attainments of concentration and insight. He distinguishes feelings that are sensually based from the feelings that arise through our spiritual practice. And then he teaches us a way to cultivate those spiritual pleasures as a support for an even more refined state of bliss, the bliss of release. In the Middle Eight Discourses, it says, the Blessed One describes pleasure not only with reference to pleasant feeling, rather, friends, the Tathagata describes as pleasure any kind of pleasure whenever and in whatever way it is found. He harnesses the strength of spiritual happiness to propel the journey beyond the conventional confines of sensory experiences. On this retreat, I don't want to hold you back from joy. I want you to enjoy your practice. And in fact, the basic meditation practices that we undertake are designed to be joyful. In the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha instructs Venerable Kassapa that he should train himself thus. I will never relinquish mindfulness directed to the body associated with joy. Thus you should train yourself. To never relinquish mindfulness of the body associated with joy. In the Samyutta Nikaya, it says, bhikkhus, this concentration by mindfulness of breathing when developed and cultivated is peaceful and sublime, an ambrosial, pleasant dwelling, and it disperses and quells right on the spot evil, unwholesome states whenever they arise. These are the basic practices that we do, aren't they? Mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the breath. One is described as associated with joy, and the other is described as an ambrosial, pleasant dwelling. I don't think we need to learn special practices in order to cultivate happiness. We just might need to understand how the basic practices of mindfulness of body and breath, when skillfully developed, are naturally practices of joy. During this retreat, we're going to look at a number of fields for happiness, a number of kinds of joy that are presented in the Buddhist tradition. I'm going to mention a few kinds tonight, but I'm mostly going to focus on the first in this evening's Dhamma talk. The first is the gladness of non-remorse, and this is a gladness, a happiness that's associated with the wholesome states of mind, of acts of virtue, of generosity, compassion, kindness, love. The second is the joy associated with renunciation, that deep contentment that comes when we can let go, when we can live simply. The third is mudita, which is sympathetic joy, which enables us to rejoice in the good fortune and successes of others. The fourth is the joy of seclusion, and this is the tranquility and delight that's associated with concentration states. The fifth is the joy of the liberated mind. And this describes the bliss of ultimate detachment, release, awakening, enlightenment. Enlightenment is also referred to as the realization of Nibbana or complete awakening. And it is not merely a placid state of detachment. It is explicitly described as a state of bliss or the peaceful state. So to cultivate joy, we must consider how we define pleasure, how we define happiness, and what we look to for the causes of our happiness. To cultivate joy, it is necessary to distinguish between the pleasure that is based upon unwholesome states that lead to craving, addiction, compulsion, sensual desire, conceit, lust. and the joy that is based on wholesome states that lead to concentration, compassion, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, letting go, wisdom. Deep and profound joy that is balanced, that is unselfish, does not require things to be any different than they actually are. Meditation does not need to be a grueling undertaking. We must feel the experiences of unselfish joy and let them touch the heart. Pause. Experience that joy. Rest in it. Let it grow within us. Let it suffuse our whole being from head to toe. We can learn to stop rushing on to the next thing, digging up the next problem to deal with, and trying to get something better, always something more, the next desirable encounter, a fantasy of a future that will be better than now, or to try to show off our successes, whether those are worldly power or praise, the desire for something. Craving and desire tend to always reach for more, but contentment and happiness are at rest and at ease. The happiness and the joy that the Buddha taught turns the mind away from sensual pleasures, away from self-centered stimulus, to realize an enduring bliss, a happiness that is not dependent upon our spouse's attention, that does not require that our favorite sports team have a winning streak, does not depend on the stock market being up or our job being successful, and it does not even depend upon our favorite hummus shop being opened when we go there. How much of our lives do we live in conflict, attachment, fear of loss, anxiety, or competition? And how much do we spend in a space of joy and ease and trust? Can you simply enjoy the presence of joy without demanding it to be more or scheming how to maintain it or judging yourself, your self-worth, and whether or not you even deserve to feel joy? And so we can begin with very simple pleasures, very ordinary, simple experiences, to notice things around us that are natural, that naturally stimulate a kind of delight. Yes, they're sensually based, but they're still very simple and ordinary pleasures, like noticing the flowers as they bloom, or the scent of the roses as you walk past, to watch two animals playing, and to take a moment to pause and to just enjoy their game. To enjoy seeing the sun rise or the sunset, or the sound of the wind in the leaves, that little flutter, that rustling sound. To walk out into the middle of the grass at night, to look up and to see the starry sky, and to just, wow, enjoy that moment, that quiet, that stillness. It's joyful to see children learning. It's joyful on a cold morning to turn on the water and to get a hot shower. It can be joyful to see a dog going on a walk, knowing full well that that dog has gone on that same round many, many, many times, but how happy the dog is to go on that walk, to sniff its neighborhood, to wag its tail, to see the various people and other smells that are around. And how soothing it can be to take off our shoes and just walk on the wet lawn. But those are simple, sensual pleasures, worth opening to, but not exactly what the Buddha was teaching. When we look to our meditation, we realize we can cultivate another kind of joy, a delight perhaps in hearing the Dhamma, sensing possibility and feeling inspired by possibility, to sense the happiness of a calm and concentrated mind in meditation. The blissful effects of those flashes of insight when we see our own patterns really clearly can be very delightful, even if what we are seeing is not so impressive, like we see our pattern of anger, or we see our pattern of fear, or we see our pattern of worry. But even if we're seeing something that's not so impressive, we can be delighted and thrilled that we are seeing it. And there's a kind of wonder to be alive, to be mindful, to be awake in the midst of all of it. In basic human ways, happiness is integrated with relaxation, with ease. I did some body work for a while that involved training in the Alexander method, the Alexander technique. And one of the various practices that we did was to do this very simple exercise where it was a breath exercise, but it began with the very simple instruction to think of an amusing, just a little light amusing thought. Something that was pleasantly amusing. I used to think of these little birds that had made a nest near my house, and I could see the little birds and the birds feeding the babies. And it always just brings a little smile, you know, a little inner smile. And as we think of an amusing, a pleasant, amusing thought, what happens often is our throat and our neck relax. Our face relax. Tension falls away. So I'd like you to just think of some pleasantly amusing thought. Something light, something simple. And let it touch you in a way that brings just a response of ease. Those little tiny enjoyments can uplift the heart, and they can help us to bring ease into sometimes difficult or tense situations, to discover joy sometimes in the midst of challenge. The Buddhist path of happiness, however, doesn't actually favor pleasant experiences over painful ones. A reliable joy cannot be based on changing, fluctuating, fickle feeling states. The Buddha focused attention on the happiness that manifests in virtuous actions, virtuous states. So the first area I mentioned I'd like to focus on now, which is the happiness or gladness that is associated with wholesome states. It's a kind of non-remorse, non-regret. And these wholesome states include mostly our virtuous actions, acts of kindness, of generosity, of compassion, keeping the ethical precepts. Acts of restraint and letting go and hearing the Dhamma teachings. You're probably all familiar with the five basic precepts. Whereas we begin a retreat, I'd like to mention these precepts and embrace them as a community commitment to living together in peace and in joy and in happiness and trust for this retreat, where we undertake the commitment to refrain from killing and harming life. We undertake the precept to refrain from stealing or taking what's not given. We undertake the training precept to refrain from sexual activity. In daily life, it's sexual activity that causes harm. But in the context of a retreat, it's to undertake a refraining from all sexual activity. To refrain from false or malicious speech, and to refrain from the use of any intoxicants, wines, liquors, drugs, anything that distorts or clouds our consciousness. When we undertake these training precepts, we can practice a very powerful quality of mind, a quality that greatest happiness, and that's the ability for restraint, to actually restrain the mind. Even if an impulse to break a precept arises, to refrain from it can bring great happiness. Any wholesome experience will leave an imprint on the mind of joy, and it brightens the mind. Participating in service projects, charitable events, offering food to people who are hungry, people who are practicing meditation, monastics. I find these kinds of actions just put me in a good mood all day long. Gifts that support meditation centers, that support the Dhamma teachings, always brighten my mind, make me very happy. They're great sources of happiness, these acts of generosity, these acts of kindness. And most of you probably know this for yourself. You probably can remember times when you've offered food to somebody, or when you've offered a donation, or when you've offered a helping hand to somebody that needs it, or you've offered your service in one way or another. Did you feel good about yourself afterwards? Did you just let yourself feel the joy of sharing, the joy of giving? People engaged in service often say that they feel that they gain more than they give, because giving brings a priceless quality of happiness to the heart. The Buddha encouraged his disciples to not only do good works, but to also reflect upon the good works that were done, because previously done good things are a resource for a wholesome form of joy, to let the mind feel that non-remorse, to let the mind feel that self-respect, that self-esteem that comes when we have done good things. I'm actually very happy to be here with you tonight. It's a delight for me, actually, to come to Israel. Although, sometimes my friends and family don't know why and wonder why, because it's a long flight. I come from California. It's a very long flight. And I have a back injury, so the flight usually aggravates my back and I'm in more pain because of it. But I'm very happy to be here nevertheless. And sometimes I ask myself why, because yeah, I'm doing practically back-to-back retreats, and it can be tiring. But even though the travel's difficult and sometimes it's tiring, I think I enjoy coming to Israel so much because of you. Because of the sincerity of your practice, because of your dedication to your practice, and because so many people in this Tovana society, in this Tovana community, really, really understand the need for peace, inner peace and outer peace, and are willing to do the work. Doesn't seem like hard work sitting with our eyes closed, but sometimes that is hard work. And I really appreciate that. And that brings me joy. It makes me want to share the Dhamma. It makes me want to come. And I find that as I'm packing in the days before the retreat, before I come over, before the flight, I'm getting happier and happier in anticipation of this visit. That happens year after year. So sometimes reflecting on the things that we can share can bring a great deal of joy, whatever it is that we have to share. And there's a wonderful moment when what we have to give is what somebody is ready to receive and is eager to receive. And then there's this feeling of being well used, which brings a lot of happiness and joy. Reflecting on our spiritual life can also be a source of great joy. thinking about our confidence in the path, on our diligence that has brought us this far, unraveling and healing the various conditioned patterns that we've discovered in our own minds and hearts, the discipline to maintain, to establish and to maintain a meditation practice. When we think about all that we have accomplished, it can bring a kind of lightness to the heart, and again, a quality of self-respect and self-esteem. Reflecting on the liberating teachings of the Buddha can quickly elevate the mind, because the thought of the Buddha is such an amazing thought. It's a superior object, one could say, and a subject that brings inspiration to the mind when we contemplate the Buddha. In the Anguttara Nikaya, it says, as he is recollecting the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, his mind is calmed and joy arises. The defilements of his mind are abandoned, just as when the head, clothes, and body are cleansed through the proper technique. And then it repeats a similar statement and then compares recollecting one's own virtues with having a mirror that is cleansed through the proper technique. These recollections of the Buddha, of the Dhamma, and of the Sangha, and of our own virtues, clean the mind. They purify the mind. And so I invite you to reflect for a moment on the qualities of the Buddha. What do you respect about the Buddha? Perhaps the purity of his conduct and virtue. Perhaps that he freed his mind from all defilement, that he was a skillful teacher, able to teach many, many different types of people, and so compassionate in the fullness of his offering that the Dhamma was truly offered profoundly and deeply. They were not held as secret teachings. They were offered openly. You might respect his diligence. He practiced very diligently, especially in his early life, but throughout his whole life. He could have hung back, lived a comfortable life. I mean, he was famous enough. But no, he continued throughout his entire life to live as a monastic, as a simple monk in the forest, as an example to all. Does that bring delight to think about the Buddha? To let ourselves appreciate and perhaps even trust or take refuge in the Buddha. And as we think about the Dhamma, this path, this teaching, it can also bring delight and happiness. There's such beautiful teachings preserved over thousands of years. Can you remember times when you've just delighted in hearing the Dhamma? Finding some passage in a text that just kind of stops you, like, wow, and brings this inspiration and joy. Or contemplating the Sangha, the community of practitioners. We can think of the Sangha as a community of ordained practitioners in a small framework. But more importantly, I think it is to think about the Sangha as a community of practitioners who are dedicated to awakening at any level, in any clothing or hairstyle, anywhere, to be dedicated to awakening. We're not alone. We're walking this path with others. We share these practices. And then to think about another level of Sangha, which is the Sangha of the awakened ones, past, present, and future. Those who have realized the Dhamma, who have realized this path. Very inspiring and brings joy to think about the Dhamma, the Sangha. And then when we think about our virtues, of course, we can remember the good things that we've done and feel happy. So these are described as being ways of cleansing the mind, cleansing the heart. When I'm sitting long retreats myself, every once in a while, my inspiration falters. I admit it. Every once in a while. So what do? Usually I turn to either a recollection of my virtues, a recollection of the Buddha, a recollection of the Dhamma or the Sangha. I turn right to these practices. My first go-to is usually a thought of the Buddha. And I just think about the Buddha, and it usually restores the inspiration and the happiness for the appreciation to practice, the opportunity to practice. This is a profound path, and when I think of the Buddha's qualities, especially I like to think of the quality of the mind that is totally free of defilement, then I think it seems easier to let go of the expectations that my practice should be easier than it happens to be at that moment, because I have a sense of the possibility, a sense of the profoundness. So why should things appear easier or be quicker than they are? They are just what they are. When I sense the profound potential of this path, that beautiful trajectory of the practice, it brings me great delight and joy to be on such a profound path. It doesn't matter if it feels like it's far away or if it feels immediate. It doesn't matter at all. I'm on the path. That's what matters to me. Reflecting on that potential is usually enough to dispel whatever discouragement might have crept into my mind. There's a Sri Lankan custom of maintaining a book of merit. And this is an old custom where the ministers would maintain a book of merit for the king. And what this involved was that one of the ministers had a duty, and the duty was to write down and record the meritorious actions, the good deeds that the king did. Now, kings in those days did a lot of things that were not so very nice. You know, they did wars and punishments and beheaded people. It wasn't such a meritorious role, usually. But they also did good things. And so this minister's responsibility was to write them down, to keep this book. And then when the king was dying and on his deathbed, the minister would remind the king of all the good things that he had done, so that he could recollect his own virtues and in that way die happily. So I don't think we should leave this to ancient Sri Lankan kings. Why don't we write our own book of virtues, our own book of merits? And I'd like to take just a few minutes of silence now. Those of you that have paper and pen, I would encourage you to just jot a list down. And those of you that don't, just sit quietly and contemplate what you might put on your list. And then when you go back to your room later this evening, please jot a few of them down. What good things have you done in your life? What are your virtues? What do you respect about the way that you've lived or the things that you've done so far? They don't have to be huge Nobel Prize winning actions. They can be very small choices that we've made. Moments when we've done something good